one person do all of this?
This process is an absolute roller coaster.
You can be very good at a very small part, but you can't be great at all of them.
What's so complicated that as an industry, we're struggling to figure that out?
Are we at this point of, if it works for me, it's right?
From a designer's perspective, curiosity goes against demand of the market.
We're now at a point where we can light spaces that were not able to be lit with older technology.
Luminaire design is in a renaissance. Even though the light source is stabilized, we can do so much more with it. It requires a whole lot of constancy of purpose from a lot of people. We start by really, really curating our sparks or our problems. Curiosity is bravery, is optimism, and we resist the temptation to develop something. That's really hard. Everybody wants to start drawing on the board. And, no, slow down. Let's really, really understand the problem.
And there is a lot of pressure to deliver in a timeline that may not be what you want it to be, but then there's that, well, you won't get the order.
Before we jump in, I want to thank five companies that show up for this community. Gotham, LEDflex, Diode LED, and Kelvix in Targetti, USA. Because this show exists thanks to their belief in designers and the work that they do every day. I'm really excited about this conversation, and I want to start where design actually begins. Every designer begins by imagining how a space should feel. Calm, intimate, creating clarity or wonder. Yet lighting too often demands compromise. Performance versus flexibility, intent versus cost, good instead of better. Gotham starts with a different belief. Those decisions shouldn't carry the weight they usually do because the right options are already built in. Their approach to architectural downlighting is designed around freedom, the freedom to explore, adapt, and refine without limitation. This is the new Gotham, where every option is already there. See it for yourself. Experience how Gotham's Ivo makes lighting design easier, faster, and more intuitive. Request a sample customized to your specs at gothamlighting.com/free samples. Now I'm excited to share this really fun conversation with Gary and Tom. Let's get to it. Today is an opportunity to learn about manufacturing and architectural lighting. When you look at the North American market, it's a $20 billion market in terms of the amount of product that gets put into production and then used every single year. There's companies that are $2 million. There's companies that are $5 billion. You guys are here representing kind of either end of that, Tom with Kelvix and Gary at Acuity. You know what you do best more than anyone else. So I'm curious, what's the one thing in the architectural lighting industry that people think about that you know isn't true?
I want to say that people think it's about product, and I'm going to say it's about service. I think you differentiate yourself on your service. Product can be similar, but really what makes the difference that I know to be true is how you service it from beginning to end.
Yeah, that's a great point. And one of the things that I've learned is that there's this myth that an architectural company can't thrive within a big company. There's this traditional story that goes, little architectural brand starts out, they're successful, designers start to fall in love with them, they become very big and very much, much more influential, and the company buys them. Then what happens? A couple of years, they still do well. A few years later, they start to go down, and then 5-10 years later, like, whatever happened to that company? That story is a story that there's history of that, but is no longer the case, I don't think. I think that there's a way to do it where you can have the magic of an architectural company within a big company and they can thrive. And I've been fortunate that being part of an acquisition from 2019 by Acuity, the TLG brands, which Eureka, Luminous, brands like that, which are actually stronger than they were when they were acquired and thriving. So that's the big thing, I think, is that architectural brands can thrive within big companies.
When you think about architectural lighting, it's a subset of that revenue market. You know, what allows you or what inspires you to stay committed and focused
to this specification market, which is, let's be honest, you know, like under 10%, maybe even under 5% of that $20 billion.
I think it's understanding what you do and what you do well. And I think part of that is it starts within the leadership of the organization too, is we want to create a segment of the market that we're going to be very good at, right? You can be very good at a very small part, but you can't be great at all of them, right? So I think once you decide where your lane is, then you look at that and then you excel in that. Then you build your process around it and you develop product. At the end, we know lighting is more about mood and ambiance, and everything that we do has to create and fill out the story that a specifier is trying to tell. So when we look at what we do and what we do well, we try to figure out what character we are in that story. And we can't be every character, because you can't be every character in a story. You can only be one. So let's find out who's going to be the most, the best character for yourself in that story.
Well, and it's interesting, because when you speak about a character, when you talk about bigger companies, we have, because of bigger scale, we have a lot more characters, right? And you mentioned the lanes. It's actually a really good way of describing it, because we have two big lanes. We have the more, I guess you could say, volume focused lanes, and you have the architectural lane. And even within architectural, there are different lanes. And so it's interesting. So you really have to be balanced. And the way we look at it across a building. There are some places in a building where maybe the ambiance you mentioned doesn't matter, right? Back of house, you just throw in a flat panel and you're good to go, right? But there are those places where it has to be special. And one thing that's really interesting is that I believe that the lighting industry, luminaire design, is in a renaissance. Because in a lot of ways, we're back to the late 90s. And what I mean by that is that the light source has stabilized. You know, the LEDs are not leaps and bounds growing every year, right? They're pretty stable. So now the differentiation happens with things like service, as you mentioned, or the optics, the mechanics, the industrial design. And so the power has swung back from the chip heads to the luminaire designers. And for luminaire designers, that's really exciting. The industrial designers, the mechanical designers, optical designers, illumination engineers. And so now the differentiation happens in that design. And that's really where I think the future is going. Now, that being said, controls is still a big piece of it. And the other piece of it is that I think we've still been focused on traditional form factors, right? Why we still have a 2x4, we have linears, whatever. That's what I think what your company does is interesting, is because you're more integrated into the architecture. Right. And that's, I think you're only scratching the surface. We're only scratching the surface out of an industry. Even though the light source is stabilized, we can do so much more with it.
Yeah. I definitely want to dive into what we can do with it. And we absolutely have to talk about controls, because there's no question about it. But before we do that, I think, you know, you mentioned this character, you mentioned this lane. It seems maybe obvious, but I don't really know. And I want to know, like, how do you go out and say, you know, we're going to pick this market and be that character, and we know it's only going to be this big, and just get into it? What does it look like to try to evaluate where you want to be?
From a sales standpoint, which is what I'm more involved in, sometimes it's gut. So, you know, I mean, really it is. You go around, you go, wow, we could do that, right? It fits with what we're doing. Sometimes it's someone at product development has this great idea. Now we sit around and we go, where will that fit? And then you kind of work from that way. Sometimes you work backwards to front, and sometimes you work front to backwards. But I think it's trying to understand where specifiers and designers want to take light. Because to Gary's point, it is. It's going back to the design side of it, as opposed to, hey, we got more efficiency. Hey, we got more of this. Now it's like, how does it fit? Because I think, and I keep on, and I'll use this probably throughout the whole thing, is we're characters in a story, right? And everybody out there is trying to tell a story. So how do we fit into it, right? So, and I think we have to be listening to the stories around us, and then we have to appeal to the people trying to tell those stories, whether it's a homeowner trying to tell a story about what his house is going to look like, or a designer trying to do something. And I think if we're out in the market and we're looking at things, and maybe we see this cool product, but we have no idea where it goes. It's our idea. Then it's us to, how do we write that book, right? How do we, and then we go try to sell that book. And I think that's where we try to get it. And like I said, sometimes it's just gut. You know, it's like, this is going to work. I know it is. And we're going to go after this market.
It's a flooded market. And like, yeah, you're a character in a story, but like, is everybody else in your storybook? You know, I wonder how far away are we from not 10 storybooks, but only 5.
I think we're pretty far.
Yeah.
And the reason why is that I believe that excellence in luminaire design of a given category, it requires maniacal focus and understanding that application space so that you can have this expertise to really create something that's tailored to what the designer is trying to accomplish within that space. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So within one of the groups that I work with, a brand called Nightingale, we launched a year ago, 100% focused on the patient and the patient care. And so it really drives everything. The passion is all about, what can we do to improve that healing environment? What can we do to help clinicians help patients heal? Or even within outdoor lighting, we have one brand that's Luminous, which is all about a luminaire that's meant to be seen, more of an architectural luminaire. And then there's one that's about Hydrel, which is about lighting things that are seen. It's very different, right? So one's about the light as an object. One is about lighting objects. And we have very, very intense debates amongst our team because there are 10 brands that we're dealing with, right? But the beauty is that we can slot these in there, and each of these brands can stay focused and not drift, because we know if we drift, well, we'll just go over the brand where that really matters.
So you guys maybe have a little bit of a luxury, because if you have something going, oh, you know, my saving grace is over here, XYZ brand. For Tom, for you guys, you are only one brand. What does it, you know, what does it mean to have that same conversation but kill the idea so that you don't go in the wrong direction?
I always say it's flexible linear. Don't call it tape. Don't call it rope. Right. The concept of it is it allows you flexibility. That's where I like to make the definition different. Right. We're now at a point where we can light spaces that were not able to be lit with older technology, right? You can't do a lot of, you couldn't do things with fluorescent, you couldn't do things with rigid fixtures, but now that we have flexible type products, we're able to put lighting in spaces that we couldn't before. And I think that's one of the beauties about what we bring as a smaller brand and a singular type focus, is that we know where we're good at and we know what we can do. And then we look at how we can solve an issue when somebody comes to us and says, I want to light that. And we're like, okay, let's figure it out. Because like I said, it's in the name, flexible linear.
All this stuff has to get manufactured. All this stuff has to, you know, have specifications around manufacturing, no matter where it's being manufactured. And I don't think it's a secret. Lighting gets manufactured around the world. Not a lot of it comes from North America. I know some stuff does, but the light, the LED, the driver components, we're not doing that here, right? So there's a lot out of our control in what is a very high-end niche boutique spec market in North America. I just probably gave the most terrible description of what product development is. So teach me, you know, what is product development? What does it look like? What are the steps from idea to install?
So have you ever sold a product that wasn't quite ready to put a little pressure on the...
I absolutely sold product that was not ready for general consumption, and that'll bite you.
Yeah, but why?
Because there's a lot of pressure in the market to deliver, right? And there is a lot of pressure to deliver in a timeline that may not be what you want it to be, but then there's that, well, you won't get the order. And there's always somebody out there. So what we try to do is really go through a really rigid toll gate process, which you're very familiar with, which has been brought into Kelvix, and we are now adhering to that. We're not going to launch anything till we've tested it, tried it, and made sure that it works, because it doesn't always end well. And not just forget cost, it's reputation. right? It becomes they care, right? They're going to launch products. It's going to last. It's going to withhold and stand up to, and it's going to do what we want it to do. And the only way you do that is make sure that you're rigid in your process when you're launching product.
Well, you said something interesting earlier that I want to make sure is framed before you educate us all, right? Like you said, because there's a lot of pressure on the market. So everything you're going to teach me, great, but like, it's pretty incredible that you somehow fit all that into this pressure of the market. And to your point, the next person is coming knocking, saying, oh, I can do that faster or whatever. Now, an infinite money stream with an infinite pool of resources is, you know, the dream boat. But you look at the most successful companies out there right now, even they can only move so fast. And I'm just going to say it. Lighting is complicated.
Every product development is a story and it's pretty intense. It requires a whole lot of constancy of purpose from a lot of people collaborating and working really well together. But what I'll start with is maybe for later, we'll say the ideation front end part, because that's its own beast of deciding what are we going to build. And the second is now we know what we're going to build. We have a product spec and now we're going to start design, right?
When you say product spec, sorry.
Yeah.
I got to learn it. Yeah. When you say product spec, what do you mean?
So that's essentially a document that you would create for your designers or your engineering team that outlines all the things that you want this product to do. Think of it as almost writing the spec sheet for the product before you develop it. And then you design the product to meet that spec.
But there's like 10 specs for every spec.
Yeah, there's a range and you have to go. I mean, these are very detailed documents. And that's just the start. And so there's a whole process before that. I think it's better hit separately. But what happens is that then you go into a development process. The first part is more fun because it's conceptual design. Whiteboarding, putting stuff on the board, all kinds of people brainstorming, working together. It's a very energizing process. And you start to narrow it down to what is the product, right? And you kind of come to the end of that and you decide, yeah, this is what we want to move into a detailed design process. And so you don't solve all the problems, you solve the big problems, and then you move in the next step, which is detailed design. Detailed design is where you're really solving all the big problems. Do we have the right thermal management? Is it going to be safe? Is it going to hang from the ceiling correctly? The list goes on and on and on. And IP69, what IP? There's a whole lot that you have to do, and even that is that's complicated, but that still stays mostly within the engineering realm. Then you have to start going wider. You pull in the sourcing team. You pull in the manufacturing team. Can we get the parts that we need? Where do we get them from? Can we build it? Can the manufacturing people help you to make it bigger? Excuse me. Can the manufacturing people build what you've designed? And then you move from there to an engineering pilot. Build it. Does it all work? Oh, crap, that doesn't work. And then you have all kinds of problems. And I'll pause here for a second to say that this process is an absolute roller coaster. And everyone is a different ride. Because what happens is that you have these compromise, you have this dream, you have this vision you're trying to realize, but then you get punched with reality. And reality says, no, you can't get that lumen output because it's too warm. No, because you can't do that. No, it costs too much. What are we going to do?
No, it needs to be done twice as fast.
That too. And so you're going through that all the time. And that's, but the interesting thing is you're going through this long process. That grit, that friction of polishing that product and making it real, and then the team getting together and attacking a problem and solving it is where the energy comes from, because you're frustrated. Why do we have to deal with this now? You come together, you solve it, you lock arms, and everybody's pumped. Okay, we're moving on to the next one. So then you're into the manufacturing process. And so now it's, can we build it at volume? Can we ship it? Can we ship it? And it's gonna get there when we get there. And he mentioned the tollgate process. Each one of these has a stage where you decide, all right, should we continue or not? You can do a hard stop, which is don't move until we do more of a continuous check-in. We're still moving, but we're checking in. It basically makes sure that you do all the stuff that you have to do to do a product right, all the UL certifications, all the tests, all that.
what's like the minimum amount of manpower it takes for this process? Like, can one person do all of this?
Yes.
I've seen companies where one person does it all.
Yeah, you can. You can. But here's where the challenge comes.
Yeah.
If you're making a very low volume product, this process I'm talking about, I'm really talking about a higher volume product. So let's just say you're shipping 10,000 of these a month. Okay. You've got to make sure that the thing is solid. Yeah. Because that's a lot of product that's going out there, and that could be very expensive to fix if you get it wrong.
And by the way, your 10,000 a month might be 10,000 a day for something else.
Sure.
Yeah. So this, what we're talking about here scales pretty fast.
You can do it as one person. I did that for a while. Right. But that's only a very limited set of things that you can do. But if you really want to scale, it requires a team and it requires time.
When you look at the team and the time, you talk about locking arms and moving forward. There's this intense roller coaster of a process that everything goes through. You mentioned manufacturing, like, okay, we've got the spec, we've got to do all this. You talked about sourcing and manufacturing. Give me the 5-cent tour of what the architectural lighting industry supply chain looks like around the world. Like, how much of this stuff is, sourced versus actually engineered and put into a system? I know it varies, but not everybody isn't making every single thing in their factory, and that's the truth.
That's such a hard question to answer because there are so many different ways that it gets done, even within our group. There are some of our products that we will manufacture the majority of the housing and everything, and there's some that we source outside. It all depends on a whole bunch of different factors. The one thing I will say is that the higher the volume, the more careful you have to be with your supply chain. So what we tend to try to do now, I use this Gotham Ivo product as an example. We looked at the factory and said, we want 90% of our products to come within 30 miles. And the whole idea behind that is that designing for flexibility for the design community, because there are so many variations that are typically required, that the longer your supply chain, the harder it is for you to respond to those changes. So the closer it is in, the more responsive you can be. But it also makes you move faster, and it's also, frankly, much more sustainable. So if you're driving something in a truck for 20 minutes versus flying it over an ocean, that's a big difference, right? I would say that what most people do is if there's something that makes you special, you don't do that yourself.
Say that again?
So if there's something that's like a secret sauce or what makes it, makes you different, you might want to do that. So if it could be, you might want to do that yourself. Yeah. Or have it very close to you.
You mentioned flying over an ocean. Tom, tape light comes from over the ocean.
That's what it does.
Flexible linear, i.e. tape light, is manufactured overseas, right? There's companies who do this extremely well for 1 million reasons that make sense. The biggest being, of course, the feasibility of economics, right? Yes, flexible linear can be $5 a foot to $50 a foot, depending on what it's doing. But in the specification grade world, you've got to care about all the things that everyone else cares about. Quality, customization. There is no standard spec. There's a standard spec, but the length is never standard, so it's always semi-custom. When you look at and compare yourself to a 30-mile radius, give me the other side of the story.
I think the secret sauce, what we try to control, is the engineering side of it. And so develop the circuitry, develop the phosphor mix, develop so that you're getting efficiency, you're getting true color rendering. You set a color point and you maintain a color point throughout your line, so you don't have colors that are mixed and matching in a, if you ever walk into a space and it's all supposed to be the same color and you immediately go, yeah, they didn't pay any attention. It can all be 95 CRI and it can all, but it's through a different color point, so you're measuring it differently. Right. So I think where we have to keep it at home is the engineering and the components that go into it. Cause quite honestly, we could make tape in the U.S., but no one's going to pay what it's going to cost per foot. And I think that's the reality of it. So why not own the engineering side of it? You try to get some IP around it so that you do have some differentiating portion of it. But that's really what we focus on, right? And the other part of our product is drivers. So maintaining, making sure the power supplies work with it. And then channels, it's extrusion. So, maybe you develop a unique shape, but at the end, all you can do there is specify thickness of the aluminum and make sure that they honor that as well as how and the shape as well. So I think that's what, in my world, that's what we try to focus on.
And when it comes to working with suppliers from overseas, we do that some as well. It's not only the engineering, but it's your relationship with the supplier. Right. I mean, you've got to be in there with them, tight with them. They know you. They know what you want. So that's the other way that you can differentiate and be special. It's that supplier relationship for those purchase parts like that.
What would you say the biggest pros are of like a vertically integrated supply chain versus horizontally? Because they both exist.
What you want to do is be able to work more on the supply chain relationship side and become as valuable as a partner to them, to your chosen suppliers. Because vertical integration, some of it has taken place in the U.S., right? There are some people out there doing some flexible linear. They've got pick-and-place machines, and they're doing it. But at scale, it's hard to compete doing 10,000 feet versus a supplier who's doing millions of feet every day, right? So they have an advantage. They have the right equipment. So our objective is to find that best supplier and then manage it effectively by having the correct relationship in that.
It's a stupid question, but I've got to ask it. How do you communicate who you are to the customer, to the design world? Like, hey, we're the 2 million foot a day tape light company versus we're the 1,000 foot tape light company a day.
We're the best service company in the light business. That's how I communicate it. I'm going to go back to that, right? Because otherwise I become a product commodity company and I'm not going to compete there.
One, for Gotham, we make all of our own reflectors because that is the most important part because that's what faces the room. It's what delivers the optics. It gives you the quiet ceiling or the not quiet ceiling, whatever you're trying to accomplish. Or Mark Architectural Lighting, we manufacture the extrusions, or we cut the extrusions in-house because we need to go to 1/8 inch increments. We can't do that out of the house. Or if we're gonna do custom connectors, that we need to finish that and do that in-house because the fit and finish is so important. So that's where vertical integration matters, so that you can enable whatever product experience you're trying to do and you want to have the most control over. That's what you want to bring close.
You talked about there's two parts of this whole process, right? You said we'll skip the first part, the fun part, and we'll talk about the intense part, the second part. Have we made it to the end of the second part yet? I don't think we have.
We haven't.
I got you sidetracked.
You did, you did.
Supply chain and sourcing and manufacturing. So once you have the materiality of it, either sourced or, to your point, manufactured in-house, what happens?
So what you go through is you do a number of manufacturing builds to make sure it does what it's supposed to do, and you get comfortable with that. But then you have the whole commercial side of it. BIM files, photometric testing, UL certification, creating all the spec sheets, the marketing materials, and launching it. That's a whole other parallel path that goes along with it. And then you launch it.
From the one individual to the multiple individuals to this entire team, what feels like the right kind of scale of that to meet the needs of this very demanding industry right now?
It's a depends question. I wish it was easy. Yeah, I mean, Eureka, for example, I'll give you a little peek behind the curtain. We typically have one industrial designer that takes a project from start to finish. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean they do everything, but they're the heart and soul of that. It's their inspiration, and they bring it through so that when it goes through all the later steps, you don't lose all the details are just right, because the person who designed it is the one who's making sure it's right on the factory floor. But if you're doing something that is a much higher volume, it requires a bigger team or a bigger scale. Some of these downlining or linear projects could have hundreds of thousands of SKU potentials, and you can't do that with one person.
We said we talk about controls, so I'm bringing it up. We're talking about lighting. Lighting's as good as dead in the water if it doesn't do what it needs to do. So there's a few things there. There needs to be design intent behind it. It needs to be installed, which means it needs to be installable, which is a lot of what you're talking about going through this process. But then it has to be controlled. Controls are not an afterthought. We are in a business of integrated systems. Pick your favorite phrase, but we're not just selling or designing lights anymore. It's always a system, right? Everything needs to dim. Nothing's the same. Nothing's compatible. Everything's the same. Everything's compatible. I don't know. What's going on? Where are we at? How do we figure that part out? Or I shouldn't say how do we figure it out, but where are we at with that in this industry right now?
The controls are key to everything, right? And anything that we design in the product development process has to be controllable and has to be agnostic from my standpoint because I don't have a control platform, right? So we need to work across multiple platforms. And then so do we design in that into the product or do we create power supplies that have modules that then communicate into those platforms? That's always the question. But if we don't, then we'll never get specified because nobody's going to want to use something that they can't control, right? I mean, if straight white light, everyone can 0-10 and anyone can, you know, forward phase, reverse phase. But you get more complicated and you get into more where we're setting scenes and we're getting more into human-centric lighting and we're trying to put this on timers through the day, and we're trying to set scenes now. The ability to do that and having the right product that will be able to be controlled but also behave the way you want it to. Because, you know, if it starts flickering or it only goes down a certain amount and it's not doing what it's not being a good character in the story, nobody wants it.
Interoperability is key, and that's key for us too. You know, we do have our own controls platform. I'm not a controls person, you know, so I probably won't go too deep here other than to say that I think we are doing a great job as an industry, maybe great, so a bit overstated when it comes to on off dimming, you know, controlling spaces. It's becoming easier and easier to get the basic controls done. And that's a lot of what our Nlight system is all about, is making it really simple and easy to commission and set up spaces and finding ways to do more and more of that. Where I think that you're talking about the human-centric lighting or whatever you want to call that, that's something that hasn't been unlocked yet, both from a technology perspective but also from a science perspective. What should that spectrum be? How should it change over time? How does that impact or not impact people? That's a really interesting area that we're exploring, but there's no definitive way to go yet.
Why is there not a definitive way? What? Lighting's complicated. I've said it twice. I'll keep counting. Should have a penny jar right here and drop one in every time I say it, right? What's so complicated that as an industry we're struggling to figure that out? Are we waiting for something?
We're making progress because it used to be there was no consensus as to what should the spectrum be, what metrics matter. You're starting to see people clump in some agreements and areas, and I can't remember the paper that came out where a bunch of industry people kind of aligned, but there's still a couple of different camps. And the research is getting stronger, but there's nothing definitive. So I think that's part of the challenge. And I think people are concerned about taking a risk and specifying something that doesn't have the research behind it.
There's a debate I want to have with a design-focused researcher and a health-focused researcher.
That would be good.
And, so this is your job to figure this out.
And I'm like, I don't know if you guys know Andrew Huberman, Huberman Lab. It's a huge podcast. He's a Stanford PhD, and he goes nerdy. At the time of this recording, like 2 days ago, so it's December, he dropped a podcast about LEDs and wavelength light, short wavelength light, and what it's doing to our mitochondria. And he found a guy. So I don't know how I'm going to find him, but if anyone who's listening knows how to find Andrew Huberman and get him or his buddy on the podcast, I think we can start there.
One thing that is a positive to build on is that if you stay away from the more physiological impact on people and what it has, if you think more psychological impact, it feels like more and more people are comfortable with warmer in the morning, yeah, cooler in the afternoon, warmer in the evening. That's a start, right? Following the what's going on out here. So that's a good thing to build on, I think.
To kind of close the door on this brief controls conversation, but is there something that's just purely curious about control still that we don't know? Or do you feel like all the pieces are at least on the table now? And as an industry, we can kind of go figure it out.
I think the pieces are there. I think now what we have to figure out is what are those pieces going to be put together to actually achieve, right? So I think once we decide what the end goal will be, then I think that puzzle can be put together, right? So if it's just dimming, you know, or changing CCT across, that's done, right? But now if we're looking at what can the light do to be physically important to you, you know, how do you make people feel better? Red light technology, is that a thing? Is it not a thing, right? You got athletes sleeping in red light beds and they swear by it, right? So, you know, are we at this point of, if it works for me, it's right? Or do we have to get to the point where there's scientific stuff to back that up?
I think that all the pieces are there. The thing that I've learned in commissioning various jobs over the last several years, some for my wife's co-working business, some for a school, it's still hard. But what I've seen is we've done that, and specifically with the Enlight team and the visual installer, they call it, it's gotten easier and easier. So I think maintaining this focus on how do you make controls easy so that it's not such a challenge to get right on a job. I think that's going to really help the adoption and make it a lot easier and improve the productivity of installers and people who are working with it.
Before we keep going, I want to spotlight someone who shares the same obsession with the design detail that this podcast is built on. At LEDflex, linear light is designed to do more than illuminate. It's engineered to shape how spaces are experienced. Rooted in British manufacturing, LEDflex works alongside lighting designers, interior designers, and architects worldwide, supporting projects where detail, precision, and execution matter. They're not just a manufacturer, they're a technical partner, providing bespoke solutions, rapid prototyping, commissioning, and long-term support from early concept through final handover. If light is integral to your architecture, choose a partner who stays with the project and learn more at LEDflexGroup.com. I also want to take a moment to share another company that I respect and enjoy learning from. I know, and you know, every designer knows the success of a space depends on actually what shows up on site. And that's where Diode LED comes in. Lighting performance isn't an add-on. It's the foundation of every successful linear lighting project. Designers need solutions that carry ideas smoothly from specification through installation. And Diode LED is built to support that reality. With industry-leading inventory, reliable delivery, and responsive support, Diode LED keeps pace with real project timelines, not theoretical ones. Real solutions for real projects, no matter the scale. Learn more about what's happening in Reno, Nevada at diodeled.com. There's also one more company that I want to introduce you to because they consistently show up where it matters. Kelvix doesn't just move fast, they move with purpose, helping the design world turn ambitious ideas into seamless, buildable realities. The Kelvix team works at the pace of your project, delivering tailored solutions backed by the people who know how quality, timing, and precision elevate the final outcome. In every spec and every collaboration, Kelvix proves lighting is more than illumination. Lighting protects design intent, sharpens the details that matter, and brings spaces to life with clarity and ease. See what's coming next from breakthrough products to standout projects at kelvix.com or on their social channels. Pretty neat, huh? All right, let's get back to the conversation.
Back to the first part of this crazy product development thing, creating something that people need to feel comfortable in the space, a product, this ideation of we could make anything. I'm sure, you know, we'd all love to hear about every whiteboard session you've had, but we'd be here for 400 more hours because there's been a lot of them. The way the curiosity comes to me in this conversation is the demand of the market, right? Is the demand of the market for all of those whiteboard sessions sustainable? Is it too aggressive? Is it off base? Where is it right now?
So you use the word curiosity, which is a really important one. And this is from a designer's perspective. Curiosity goes against demand of the market. Yeah. And what I mean by that is that demand of the market means that you're designing something that someone else has probably already done. Or, and that's one way of developing new products, is looking at what's out there. Is there a gap? Let's just fill the hole. I call it design by competitive comparison. That's not the creative side, right? That's that more demand driven. Earlier we're talking about the front part. That's one way you figure out what to do, is just finding those gaps. And you want to have projects like that, because those are the projects that you know you can invest in, and you know they're probably going to have a return. They're very predictable. But they don't move the bar of the industry. They don't create new things that help designers create amazing experiences like. So that's the part, frankly, that my whole career I've been most passionate about.
I'm going to make it more boring for a second, but it's like, you know, sustaining engineering versus like true innovation. I'm going to reframe that demand part to like, well, things also just have to be updated. Like, yeah. Suppliers may disappear. Market dynamics might change. Construction doesn't stop. Specifications can't just completely be rewritten. There's all this is on you. This is so much demand on a manufacturer. What gives? You know, like how can you communicate back to the market the rate that you can adapt and change such that the system supports it, not just, you know, asks and asks and asks and asks?
I've got a closet full of one-off creative items that never were commercially viable except for one item for one time, right? And I think one of the benefits of being on the smaller end of it is that we can afford to take some risks around there. And we can look at, we're going to go solve this one problem and then we think it's the greatest thing. And then we're going to go try to sell it. No, well, that's not my problem. You know, so you got to really start with what is the market first. But I think from that standpoint is just being able to solve something and being agile and nimble enough to be able to do that on the fly is something that our customers look forward to. But we also have constraints inside of our own supply chain and our own manufacturing that we have, you know, sometimes the best answer is no, or sometimes the best answer is it can't be done, at least by us. But I think the ability to be nimble and agile and being able to kind of take standard product, as you let off with, you know, what is one thing, and you know, that's why I don't have a catalog, right? That's why Kelvix doesn't have a catalog. It's not a product company, right? It uses products, right? So I think the key has to be, how can we be curious enough, help the designer realize what they have, and create something within the constraints that we're limited by?
Yeah, but I think to this question, though, is interesting, is that certain product types you design knowing that you're going to get all those requests. Because that's just the nature of the business. Linear lighting, 100%. We know people want to do crazy stuff like follow a stairwell up and that be visible. So a light is a perfect example of that. We have three people who that's all they do is get on the phone with designers and agents and make custom stuff. Not custom is probably the wrong word. Heavily modify something every day and make standard products fit whatever they're dreaming up. And it's so much fun to do that. But there are some that are more rigid that we maybe can't. But you'd be really surprised at how many modifications we do on a daily basis because of the nature of what you're saying the industry is.
What does it mean to not react to demand, but generate it in the architectural lighting space?
It starts with really understanding the problems that a customer is trying to solve. I know that sounds very trite and overused, but it's very true. And when you're, and this is where we're starting to move towards what I consider more true innovation, is where we, whenever we develop these processes for innovation that are very different. And the idea behind it is that we start by really, really curating our sparks or our problems, and we resist the temptation to develop something. And that's really hard because you have a whole bunch of really creative people. Everybody wants to start drawing on the board and let's design this now. No, slow down. Let's really, really understand the problem. And so we narrow those problems down to these really specific things. And where do these problems come from? So they come from all the time that we spend with designers. Sometimes we actually involve designers in helping us create those sparks. Asking them what product they want is not the way to do it. No. It's understanding what they're fighting every day, what's keeping them up at night, what's frustrating them. And then once you have that, you curate that, then there's this inference or this moment that you have to have of taking that problem and turning it into the more specific problem statements you try to solve. And this is where it gets interesting, because now you shift into the more of the brainstorming part of the process. And what's really fun about this, use the word curiosity before. One other word, when it comes to innovation, it's curiosity, it's bravery, it's optimism. Optimism that you're going to find the problem. Because you go into these brainstorming sessions and you're like, are we going to find this? I don't know. I believe we are. And so you go into it, and then the energy of the room starts. We bring people who are across the company. And I believe that anybody can innovate. And so you bring them in, and then every event has a different moment where something emerges and you feel it. You're like, oh yeah, we're onto something here. And it could be just when a rendering pops up on the screen or a sketch. And that's where that optimism, curiosity come together, and you're like, that's it, we found it. And then you know that you've got a real long road ahead of you before it actually becomes real. Right. And that's where this idea of constancy of purpose of design comes. And I think the design community has this as well, because they're working on a building that's not even out of the ground yet. It's just a vision in their mind, right? In that respect, we're similar, that we're just sketching and thinking, and we know it's going to be way down the road. But then but you have such a belief in what your design vision is, whether you're a lighting designer or a luminaire designer, but then you've got to fight its way all the way through. Yeah. And that gets less fun, but it's what it takes to bring these really crazy game-changing ideas to reality.
Was it easier to fight that fight when LED was hot to trot 15 years ago?
I would say no. I think there was less innovation, because it was more about what I was talking about earlier. See, the innovation was on the LED,
right?
Okay. And the driver.
It was blue and it was white.
Yeah, and you're packaging it differently. Right. And I mean, yes, there was definitely innovation that happened during that time, but I think people were so engrossed with trying to learn how to apply it, how are we going to bend it, how are we going to get the color right, that I think in some ways there was less. And I think there's going to be more true luminaire design innovation moving forward.
I want to take a moment to recognize a team that understands what every designer already knows. Light isn't a fixture. It's the soul of a space. For almost a century, Targetti has shaped how people experience architecture, using precision optics, performance, and that unmistakable sense of Italian design to elevate every moment a space offers. Because light isn't just seen, it's felt. It drives emotion, guides the eye, and transforms intention into atmosphere. For Targetti, light isn't simply the medium, it's the identity. It's the craft, the legacy, and the commitment behind every solution they create. Experience it for yourself. Visit TargettiUSA.com. Now, let's jump back into this conversation.
Yeah, you said earlier we're kind of in the Renaissance, like we're in the 90s of luminaire design. there is a frustration in this industry that we, quote, haven't had anything cool. Now, do we need it? There's a whole debate around that. Like, design can do so much for people already. But at the end of the day, we all love cool new stuff. We all love an opportunity to be first. Change is hard. The change is good. How much has our industry changed in the last 15 years? And what does that set us up to be excited about?
We talked about it earlier. There's going to be control. That's how it's really going to change, is how do we do it? I think there'll be innovation around efficacy. I think we're going to see that. I think Europe is pushing us into that. I think getting more efficiency out of it. And then the other thing I think is the renew, reuse component of it, making things modular, right? How do you keep things fresh and not create a bunch of waste? Right. I think that the younger generation of designers are very concerned about, waste and the environment. And, we rip out stuff after 5 years and we throw the whole thing away. Right. And it just sits in a landfill. Right. So I think true innovation will come around. How do we do that? How do we keep it fresh? How do we make components reusable but change the overall look? And how can we do that as a group and make it that we keep into mind sustainability as we look at things like that?
You use the 15-year was changed. It's interesting.
I just picked 2010, first LED troffer.
Yeah, because everything's changed in that time, right? And that's why it's a little contradictory what I said about being a renaissance. And controls have become ultra important, and there's a lot more controls on each project. And so it's a controls in some ways is becoming more and more controls first or controls balanced. We know that designers have to adapt to whatever their project is. And beginning is what kind of problems are you trying to solve? And as we go along, here's a potential solution to your problem. What are we missing? And that's where in those discussions, you start to hear the things that they're thinking about how they might use it. Well, could you add that kind of a link? Could you add that kind of amount? Could you do this kind of link? Can you make it so I can do this or that? And so it's much better to hear that while you're still in development than after you're done and they're asking for the modification, because you can design for it when you're in the middle of it.
So there's this conversation, this chatter, right? The ideas of the design community. It's a longer conversation than today, but it's something that's become very obvious. There was that 15-year period of what we'll call the technology development now into product development. And the technology wasn't perfect at the beginning, and it's rearing its ugly head right now because we didn't know everything. That's okay, right? There's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of curiosity. There's a lot of market demand to fix that problem. But maybe that problem's already 10 years old and we have fixed it. Or maybe that problem of, give me an easy to specify fluorescent based LED system isn't actually the ask. Like, how do you frame that big problem in your world right now?
One of the things that's coming to mind that may or may not be directly tied to that is that this whole idea of engaging with designers, it's a very ad hoc kind of way that we do things, meaning you probably have your relationships, I have relationships across our company, whatever. I've always wondered, the thing I think about is maybe there's somebody out there who has an idea, but how can there be a tighter connection between design community and manufacturers? I know it's kind of tough because there's so many manufacturers.
And there's so little time and they have none.
Yeah.
And they make money based off billing their client. When they're talking to you, they're not doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Correct.
Once a year is fine, but once a week ain't. Even if you paid them, they don't have that time.
Here's the interesting thing is that time spent can result in products that are much better for them for the problems they're trying to solve.
Yeah. This is a cyclical problem to a certain extent, right? There's a lot of chicken and the egg stuff in here. I need another penny jar for those, right?
Yeah.
Lighting is complicated, and what's the chicken or the egg? Who leads, who follows? When we look at kind of the next wave, right? The next opportunity of totally integrated systems. Product is one thing, but you mentioned service is a huge part of your business too. Relationships drive construction. AI is not going to replace construction. Not in my lifetime, right? Technology is great, but like this is a manual process. I think it would be awesome if you could share just a little bit about your current manufacturing process and how, yeah, streamlined or fluid it is, but like people are still doing all this stuff.
I think in ours, it's like Wizard of Oz. There's a lot behind the curtain that goes on that people don't see, you know, and when people go, oh, I just need you to make this really quick. All it is this, right? What they don't go into and realize that, have they ever tried to take a 12 millimeters wide strip of tape and put a 22 gauge wire onto a solder pad that is half that size and then get it to stick, right? You know, there's skill involved, right? There's an effort involved. And then cutting it to the right length. And there's a lot of manual process and then packaging it so that it arrives on site, right? There are so many steps inside the manufacturing process. When it shows up, yeah, it's a neat little 4-foot fixture with a lead wire on it, right? But, you know, it took several steps in the manufacturing process to get that and to get it right. You know, I can put stuff together, but I'd probably, you know, if I soldered something, I'd probably burn a hole in the solder pad before I got it to stick, right? Because I don't know what I'm doing. So, but I think that there's a certain amount of skill that people don't realize that it's not as simple as it looks, right? And if you were into our facility, you would see these little stations and you're like, well, that still doesn't look complicated. But the amount of work that these people have to put out and measure correctly, cut correctly, make sure that we're wired correctly is very important. You know, and it's not just slapping, peeling and sticking. And
yeah, I mean, people are still building all this stuff every day.
The variety of products that we've been talking about that are required make it very difficult for it to be anything other than what we're talking about, because it is so different. You know, automation works great if you crank out 10 million of the same thing with no variation, right? You can optimize the process.
But that's not spec.
That's not spec. Yeah. But what is important, you know, is that, you know, kind of our approach is that obviously we're talking about product vitality here, right? And service is kind of part of what our strategy is. And then using technology to improve productivity. What I mean by that is that in our manufacturing cells where we have a lot of manual work going on, we've really started to implement a lot of machine vision to double check what's going on and to make sure everything, so tests along the way. In addition to, at the very end, we have an extremely sophisticated testing system to make sure the color and the binning is all right. So, you know, we're layering in technology to help us move faster and be higher quality, but there's a limit to what you can do.
When you look at everything you know today in your professional career, you guys have, I didn't even ask earlier, but I think it's like a combined almost 50 years of experience in this industry. You've seen a lot. You've done a lot. There's a lot of myths out there. Bust one for me.
Change is simple. I you know, hey, I just want to change this one length. Okay, there's 15 components I now have to cut and change, right? So I think that the myth is that it's just a simple request. Why can't you do it? Or why is it taking so long to get it done? I think that myth is, I think that's something that is out there. I don't think that everyone fully understands some of the complexity. It may appear simple, but some of the complexity that goes into making one simple change.
Let's role play that real quick. Orders in, these 10 need to be 2 feet shorter. What happens inside the doors of your manufacturing facility to make that change?
That's easy. That's just because I can cut it. Now, if it's the other way around, I can't pour water on it and make it grow, right?
Okay. So, all right. They have to be 2 feet longer then.
You have to draw it. You have to configure it. You have to do the power consumption to make sure that you didn't add and overload the driver that was, or the power supply that was previously specified, because now you've got...
Let's go penny jar. 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour. Where they're like... 2.5 hours of work.
I think it's 2.5-3 hours worth of work, right? And then it's
how many people's desks?
Three. It's not a simple change.
Myth busted, Tom. Good job. What do you got, Gary?
I think some people believe that they can't innovate. And I think everybody has a little bit of innovator in them. And you can find that. It doesn't, some people are more predisposed to being creative, but I've been amazed in the right process. People who think that, who are black and white, totally by the book, these amazing ideas can pop out. One of the, one of my most favorite products that I've ever worked on, the inspiration came from a tech who was in the room doing some work. He just looked up and said, "Why don't y'all just do this?" And that's what fixed it. So that's, maybe that's my myth, is that everybody can participate and make a big contribution to innovation projects.
Myth busted. All right, we'll have to get you guys cool, funny wigs and mustaches like the guys from Mythbusters next time that we do this, but I appreciate it.
It's just dramatic the way that we did it. Exactly. Yeah, I'm going to blow some stuff up. Yeah.
My last question for both of you today, and it means so much to me and everyone that listens to this, but, you know, what keeps you alive and motivated in what you do every day?
I'm going to say interaction with people, both clients, customer-facing, because I can learn more about the industry. And I think internally, because I can learn so much that I don't know on process, right? So, because everyone that that works at Calvix has a unique set. Like you said, they could pop up with the greatest ideas. That keeps me going every day, as well as being in front of that customer and being able to explain what it is that makes us different. And why would you choose Calvix? I think that's what invigorates, that's what gets me up out of bed every day.
So for me, it's an interesting one, because I'm fortunate to have a good-sized team I work with. And we've talked about stuff that's very tough to do, right? But it can be very rewarding. And what I'm focused on every day is creating an environment and a culture where people love what they do. And that's something that's kind of rare, I think, in the world. Because if you're going to be spending all that time, shouldn't you be enjoying what you're doing? And so that's kind of my mission within the team, is to do that, to create that environment where people who are creative, who are excited and want to create the future of lighting, can do so and be passionate, invested, and love doing it. And when I see the teams interacting and creating and working together, and I see that magic happen, that's when I get fired up. And then when I see the results of it, whether it's that moment in a brainstorm where, bam, there it is, or when I'm walking through an airport and I see a product that was a part of the team who designed it doing what it was supposed to do, or a designer is taking it somewhere we never even thought it would go and made it even better. So that's where it all comes to fruition. But primarily building that culture where people love what they're doing.
I think you both mentioned it. It's people, right? It's this opportunity to be creative, to collaborate, and to just be a part of that team. Manufacturing doesn't have the word design in it, right? And it doesn't have the connotation, but it's very much a part of it, of the experience and the opportunity. And I think we see it so much in the celebration of awards and the celebration of marquee projects and the celebration of, like you said, like, I mean, people are driving that stuff like, "Hey, like, kids, look, I made that and I was part of that." And like, you know, like, there's so much pride in being a part of something that comes together. And I think, simply put, it matters, because no two buildings are the same, especially when you come to it with a strong and focused design intent. I want to thank you both for sharing your side of the story to this. I know you're just two people working at companies that have a lot more working in them. But you know, you also represent a large cross section of what goes on in this industry. And I know that you're our partner on the Light Pod as well. And you give us the opportunity to create this forum and this environment. And I just want to thank you both for that as well.
Bet. Thank you.
Thank you. And like we always say, you do not notice good light, but you sure notice bad light.
That's right.
Absolutely. And I do have one piece of homework for you, Tom.
Okay.
I want to know what character I'm in and what book I'm in.
Oh, you heard about that.
Get back to me on that one, all right?
Yeah, Bilbo Baggins.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
See you.
Thanks.